Welcome to Lexis, the podcast all about language and linguistics. I'm Lisa Casey.
I'm Jackie Glancy.
And I'm Dan Clayton. So we're delighted to be joined on this episode of Lexis by Ife Thompson, who is a lawyer and community activist from South London. She's particularly interested in Black British history and culture, issues of social, racial and linguistic injustice, and she's currently writing a book called Black British English for Palgrave Macmillan. She's also just started the Black British English podcast. So thanks very much for joining us, Ife.
Thanks for having me.
And you're also involved, aren't you, and founded, I think, BLAM UK. And that's got it. It's hard to focus on Black British culture, history, heritage. Can you tell us a bit about that work you do with BLAM and what its aims are?
Yeah, so BLAM stands for Black Learning, Achievement, Mental Health. And we focus on three things in particular: education, advocacy and mental health. And we are set up to support the Black community in the UK. So under education, we go into schools teaching Black history. We work with our partner schools, and we're there every single day of the week in different partner schools, delivering sessions to primary school and secondary school age children, Key Stage 2 and Key Stage 3, on Black history and, as you said, culture and heritage projects as well. We also do teacher training as well. So we've delivered a number of training sessions around the UK for different teachers to ensure they incorporate Black history in the national curriculum. And one thing that we picked up when doing that, because like a majority of the teaching force is white, but also even when a lot of teachers are trained up, the curriculum that they're taught to teach is based around whiteness. So they had very little chance to engage with any Blackness or learn about any Blackness themselves. And then a lot of them would say to us that we want to teach Black history, but we're really nervous that we're going to get it wrong or we don't know what to teach. So it inspired us to create our book. So we created our first book. It took 3 years of hard work and labour, but it's essentially mirroring the national curriculum. It covers history, maths, art, drama, poetry, you name it, it's there. Yeah. Even linguists and linguism and stuff like that, it's all in that. It's all in that book. And the aim is just to really ensure teachers have a wide range of topics that they can teach. It's got lesson plans, it's got worksheets based on the work that we've been doing with young people in schools. Then in terms of our advocacy, we support Black children excluded from school, but we also campaign on issues that affect the Black community. So one of our really big campaigns that we've done was a campaign against a school in South London that had banned Black British English terms, which is basically stifling Black British English speak and language users. So we did a campaign against that school and they changed some of their policies. But that was one of our big entry work into like linguistic justice work. Because even before that, with the young people we're working with, a lot of them are fluent Black British English speakers. So in terms of the content we create in schools, we create content to affirm those linguistic speakers, ensure that they know that they're speaking a language and also that they have pride in speaking Black British English. So that it came in two forms. It came through the advocacy, but also through the direct work we're doing in schools. And that even in the book, we have chapters on African-American vernacular English, Creole languages, because a lot of that culture and history and heritage is also in language. So we incorporate that into the work that we do. And then lastly, in terms of well-being, we do workshops in schools, but also we have a group online-based therapy with Black therapists on racial wellness. And we look at how racism causes trauma, like racial trauma and race-based anxiety, but also how we can live racially well whilst living on a system of white supremacy and anti-Blackness. So the projects are across those three different, I guess, ideas and ideologies. And we've just kind of ensured the projects meet the aims of like, how can we support our community in, you know, being racially well, having their identity affirmed and kind of pushing back against different ways we are still oppressed. So I always say BLAM is a permanent site of resistance. Yeah, that's how I like to describe it.
And I guess, you know, language sits in the middle of a lot of that, doesn't it? Because it's a sort of thread through some of that. What's your own kind of background in language and your interest in language? Where does that sort of stem from?
So growing up, I spoke Yoruba. So like my parents are Yoruba, so I speak a lot of Yoruba. So I learned Yoruba from my mother speaking it to me, actually. So I already had that in my household. And then my mom would also speak, and my dad would speak Nigerian Pidgin. So I always knew that as well. So in terms of, like, even before I got to the classroom, I already had two languages I was already speaking. And then same for, I guess, English as well. So I've always kind of fascinated with language because I'm bilingual, multilingual because of that. And then in the school space now, especially living in Brixton, I then was around a lot of people from Jamaica, a lot of people from Caribbean heritage, and often in the classroom, especially in Brixton, you'd hear a lot of Jamaican patois. I went to Jamaican church as well. So I was, like, always around Jamaican patois speakers as well. And then I guess in primary school, that's when I started, like, learning Blackbridge English and actually becoming, I guess, involved in developing Blackbridge English as a language speaker. So I guess all of those different identities, speaking different languages and being around different languages, really sparked my interest. But because I'm interested in Black history anyways, and language is a feature, I was always kind of interested because of that. And I remember, like, even in secondary school, learning poetry by John Agard, which was written in Jamaican patois and stuff like that, written in Creole. It was really, really interesting for me to, like, learn poetry from different language speakers written in either Creole or other Creole languages. That was of great interest to me, like, learning that. So I think it was always there. But because in the UK we don't have, like, a subject of, you know, language studies that incorporate linguism, like, it's not all linguistics, like, it's always just, like, you're learning French or you're learning English or you're learning German or Latin. And I'm always like, Latin is even a dead language, but in my school, learning Latin is, like, for the gifted and talented people. So it's like, even the languages that were taught to, like, have reverence for, like, what even though I was in a Black majority school, my school was literally 99% Black people, we never learned about the closest we learned about any sort of, like, Creole languages was in English doing poetry, because we had such a diverse, and I think even in that poetry anthology, you had Nigerian Pidgin because there was a Nigerian poet, but that was the closest we got to engaging with Creole languages, even though majority of the school was Black. So we had a range of languages that we could have, it would have just been very relevant to us. But we never had a chance to engage with that at all. And I guess growing up, even the fact we didn't learn Black history, that was enough for me to radicalize me anyways. But I feel like the older I got, the more I became interested in linguists and linguism. But I would say that in terms of my introduction to linguistics, it was definitely more as an adult, like, having the right tools to know, like, okay, this is what this is. And I think the work of, like, April Baker Bell really, like, got me thinking about, like, my own views and understanding of, like, Black language, because I guess I knew about it, and, like, within BLAM we were doing it in the schools before I was reading April Baker Bell's work, but I guess never had scholarship of a Black linguist, and April as well gave me that, and she gave me so much more. But I guess I was always interested in it because I was a Black language speaker. I never really had the chance to fully be immersed in it. And actually, no, I did learn about the work of Professor Herbert Devenish, and he's a Jamaican linguist, and he's absolutely amazing. And I think he actually helped develop my understanding of, like, Creole or Black linguism as well. But all of that was when I was an adult. But what I would say is, I remember actually in secondary school, and I guess sometimes you're researching, you don't actually realize you're actually engaging in linguistics, but you know you're engaging in things that relate to your culture. I remember actually researching about Sierra Leonean Creole and Jamaican patois, because we had, like, I had a big community of people that was from Sierra Leone in my school as well, and, like, they would say, like, picking, and we say picking as well in Nigerian Pidgin, and Jamaicans say pickney. So I remember we'd be like, oh my gosh, our languages are, like, so similar, like, how is that? And, like, we just talk about it in school together, and, like, we'd research it, and we'd, like, go on Google saying, oh, this word is similar, but we're just doing it because we're all speaking language, and we're like, oh wow. But but when I think about it now, we were actually engaging in a linguistic session together, like a real life oral linguistic session, but we never really saw it like that. Like, I mean, you're in year 9, year 8. It's like, oh, we speak Creole, and oh, this is similar, but we never really thought we were we were doing that. But I guess when something's innate to you, you would have that conversation, but you just weren't not couch it as this is a linguistic session. It's just a conversation with your friends. But then now I'm actually sitting and thinking back at it. We were actually engaging in linguistics, Creole-based linguistics, that we never were afforded in the classroom space. I think they're quite beautiful, actually. But yeah, those are my different, I guess, entry points. Yeah. But I guess in terms of actually, you know, from an academic point, probably as an adult, but I guess I've always been engaging with it as a young person. And even little things like reading books, like you should just get one, was it a book? But I guess it was literature that was in the base of a text-based decolonial, was in the Black British English. We were like all reading stuff like that, and it was the norm. So I guess even if we weren't studying it, we were like engaging it as a practice as language speakers. So I was reading this kind of stuff, speaking like that on Facebook, Bieber, whatever. Yeah. So I guess even just being a Black British language speaker in and of itself is a way of affirming identity and culture, but also taking part in new language creation. But I guess when you're actively taking part in it, you don't really realize it until you're like older. You're like, oh my gosh, like we're speaking a language and we're doing that, and there's music and this and that. And then you kind of trace steps back. But when you're like young and you're just engaging, it's just very natural.
Mm.
And I imagine this is all material that you're drawing on because you're currently writing a book called Black British English. So could you tell us what inspired this, what you're writing about particularly, and where language fits into wider Black British culture?
Yeah, so I guess for me, the reason why I really wanted to write the book is because there's actually nothing, there's no book like that out there. Like, right. It's very under-theorized. And I guess I felt like even in a lot of movement organizing about like racial justice, issue of language justice was left out.
Right.
And that's something I saw as a reoccurring theme. And I was thinking, is it because of how damaging and how prevalent language supremacy is, that it's become ingrained and normalized, that it's not a wider part of the movement? Is it because a lot of us have become succumbed to principles and ideologies in language injustice, and language supremacy, that we don't unpack it? Because a lot of activism can be based around intellectualism and like the academy sometimes, and like reading certain books, you know, and that can be quite alienating. But also, even the books it's written in, like, especially if it's academic tech, is going to be very, like, you know, standardized English, but also English that is not as accessible as your day-to-day English, right? Mm-hmm. So is it that a lot of us that are engaging in this work that maybe have an academic space are also, you know, very much, I guess, engaged in upholding language supremacy? I had to unpack that myself. Think about why is it that we don't show up for Black British English speakers or queer-based speakers? What is the stigma around that? So I guess, I mean, we've all been educated in the UK and grown up being indoctrinated, and I guess become normalized the way in which we see standard English and what language is upheld as the right way of speaking. So, and it's been years and years, you know, of that. So I guess for me, I wanted to unpack that. I wanted to unpack, what does language justice look like in the Black liberation space? And it was just kind of finding a path to do that. And I guess with the work I was doing with BLAM anyways, I was already looking at the Creole languages and thinking about, okay, how can we incorporate that into the work that we do, and how can we make sure that we show up for the young people that also Black British English speakers? Because I remember when I went into primary school, like 8-year-olds, it was speaking to me, like how I speak to my friends. I was thinking, hold on, you guys sound just like me. It's like your parents are obviously fluent Black British English speakers, or you're picking it up, same way in the school setting. But there has to be something to affirm that. So then I think that kind of made me really want to create a space where, at least for the newer generations of Black British English speakers, they felt affirmed, they felt seen. Right.
So do you have a particular audience in mind for your book? Are you writing it for a particular audience, do you think?
Yeah, so it's for Black British English speakers.
Yeah,
it's to affirm them. So I'm writing to Black British English speakers to, I guess, assist them in their language, their journey towards like feeling liberated in using language. Because I feel like a lot of them already, you know, are fluent Black British English speakers, and they use the language and they use it in songs, they use it in their speech. But then they may often code switch. They may often feel as though there's something inherently wrong with with being a fluent Black British English speaker, or may have internalized, like a lot of us have, and I had as well, ideas of language supremacy and ideas rooted in colonization and imperialism on standard English. So it was to kind of provide an entry point that is decolonized but also affirming to Black British English speakers. So they'd be like, actually, you know what? I'm bilingual, and actually there's nothing wrong with the way that I speak, and actually all languages are valid. I mean, there's no such thing as a language being more superior, because the whole purpose of language is to communicate. But what we do know is this is white supremacy, and that, you know, affects every aspect of life, including language. So I really wanted to affirm that with new speakers, but also to give them the tools to navigate language justice from a political standpoint. So giving them the tools to advocate for themselves and actually call certain things out, and to know where certain things are coming from. So if they have certain feelings about the way they speak, or, you know, ideas or certain ideologies, they know where it comes from. So when you name, when you can name something, it's easier to like work towards bringing it down or decolonizing it, you name it. So I think it was to kind of, one, affirm them, but two, for the wider non-Black British English speaker, to give them the tools to understand how they are actively harming Black British English speakers and what they can do to affirm them. So for teachers, there's a whole section in the book for like language justice in schools, same for like language justice in the courtroom, because those are two spaces that I've heavily been involved in, and I've seen language injustice happen time and time again for Black British English speakers. So I wanted it to be a pathway for like even people that are not Black British English speakers to show up for them as well. But the whole book is an ode to like how Black British English is seen in like literature, in the arts, and like music, in social media, like especially like Twitter, YouTube, like how Blackness has become mainstreamed, how it's been wrongly like miscategorized as UK slang or multicultural London English. So it's kind of like also looking at the history of the language as well, and how it's influenced wider culture, but also like how language was created, like how it is inherently linked to like Black British culture and Creole-based languages like Jamaican Patois, which is a massive influence, or like the base of Black British English, and how actually by calling it UK slang, you're taking away from the Blackness of the language. So it's really giving a history lesson, and I love history. I'll say there's a lot of history and language and culture. So it's a mixture of like my love for history, but also my desire to really want to affirm and show up for Black British English speakers in a way that hasn't been done before. And I really just want to create a new wave, I guess, or a new way of like thinking in terms of like what Black liberation looks like in the context of language justice. Yeah. And I want that to become the norm. I want it to be like everyone advocating for language justice. And that's what the forefront of our liberation work. So, yeah.
And that's, you mentioned about April Baker Bell and linguistic justice. I mean, that's one of the things, I mean, there's loads of good things about that book and about April, but it's like the book itself there's so much in there to think about, but it's also the way it's written is not like your kind of dry, academic, stuffy kind of prose, is it? It's really, it's readable, it's like engaging. Is that something you're kind of thinking of in the sort of style that you're using for, you know, for your book?
Yeah. I'm really against like this idea of, and I think it is rooted in this idea of language supremacy, that, you know, you have to use complex and less accessible words to seem smarter. Because I just don't like that. I think language should be accessible to everybody, and that includes like how we impart information. So the book will be using the most accessible, you know, most relatable way of speaking mainstream English. But what I would also say as well is that with the book, I'm trying to ensure that even like I include Black British English in the writing style, because as I said, my point of contact is I'm writing this book for Black British English speakers. It's to affirm them, but it's also for them to feel seen and to feel appreciated. So it's written for them, and everybody else is an afterthought. So I'm basing it around them, around the kind of thing that I would like to have read as a Black British English speaker entering this topic. So it's based around them. And a lot of it, I'm doing like interviews with people as well.
Right, interesting.
And I'll be incorporating that into the book. I'm doing surveys with people as well that are fluent Black British English speakers. Because I'm just trying to make sure the book is as decolonized as possible, but also as relatable. And I think the way in which something is written as well affects how relatable it is, but it's not going to be an academic, like, stuffy text. My audience, I've said this to my publishers from the onset, my audience is the Black British community, Black British English speakers in particular.
And you've got a good relationship with your editor, have you?
Yeah. No, my editor's really supportive because I think she knows the value of the book and why it's needed and why now. And from what I sent her the pitch, like, she was, like, in love with the book. Like, you know, so she's really supportive. But, and I think for me, it was really important to go with a publisher that understood the need for this book. Mm. Like, this book is long overdue. So, yeah, she's very supportive. And I just think that, yeah, I'm really excited to be writing. I think when I mentioned to people, I'm like, oh my gosh, there's, like, literally nothing like that in the UK. I mean, I've been saying this for the longest time. Like, there are, like, literally no or hardly any Black linguists in the UK.
Yeah.
Very, very few. I've been looking and I've seen people that are coming up that are, like, just kind of entering the space. Mm. But, like, America, you've got, like, whole departments on in American vernacular English.
Yeah.
You know, you've got loads of local linguists doing the work. You've had Ebonics, you've had that history. But in this country, linguism still remains extremely white. It's a very white space. And work needs to be done around decolonizing that. But also, I feel like, for me, it's important to have linguists or people doing this work of language justice that are the language speakers.
Because
there's only so much you can engage with a language being outside looking in.
Yeah.
You need people that are fluent language speakers also being able to write on their work. They should be the leaders or, like, the leading writers and thinkers because that's their language.
Yeah, and exactly.
I think that something needs to be done as well.
Yeah. I mean, that's something maybe we can sort of circle back to again with, you know, in the final question when we talk a bit more about your sort of arguments about MLE. Is that okay?
Sure.
Just going back to the sort of stuff around sort of anti-Black discourses around language, you wrote on the BLAM blog back in 2022, I think, about sort of media coverage of language issues and how they often present kind of anti-Black language discourses. You talk in the blog about terms like roadman being used as a sort of stereotypical kind of label that, you know, describes a whole way of speaking, a whole way of living, but also, you know, the implications of it criminalising Black British English speakers as well. What's going on with that? I mean, particularly given your interest in language, but also, you know, your day job as a lawyer, there's obviously quite a big overlap there, isn't there?
Yeah, massive overlap. And I think for me, the patterns that I was seeing that the media are, like, reproducing anti-Blackness, I've seen it in the courtroom as well. That it was this idea that Black British English is inherently tied to a roadman lifestyle. You know, there's nothing wrong with a roadman being fluent in Black British English because, to be honest with you, language is for everybody. So there's no exclusion. Like, you can't speak Black British English because you're a criminalised person. That's irrelevant. But what we're seeing is that there's a portrayal, the language used by Black British English speakers is reserved for people involved in criminalised conduct. And that's far from the truth. So you're literally criminalising an entire body of speaker. My suggestion is this: these words are reserved for criminal conduct only. When this is words that are used in day-to-day language use, and it has a range of different meanings and different contexts. Of course, any word in any language can be used for criminal conduct, but the language in and of itself is not a criminal term. But with what you see uniquely with BBE is that they characterize majority of the language as this is to do with criminal conduct, and whenever it's used by anybody talking about criminal conduct, and that has really dire effects for Black British English speakers who will use it in music and a rap as an art form, and they are told, and we see it by the police and the prosecutors, and the police will position themselves as experts, but they're not experts in Black British English, but they position themselves as experts, and they explain that this term is solely used for those involved in the drug market, and it only means that, when actually the word used by all Black British English speakers in a range of contexts, and the word in of itself is not a conduct word. So yeah, we have that a lot, and it's used and it's weaponized in the courtroom.
Just going to say, what sort of examples, I mean, are you thinking of in terms of specific kind of words associated with, you know, that sort of field?
So you would say, like, someone is the plug, and that means someone is the person that is the connect, or the person that, you know, they put you on something. And BBE speakers use that in all contexts to talk about, oh, this person got me this, they're a plug, or this person, you know, introduced me to this hairdresser. They're the plug. So the plug is used by BBC speakers in a range of different ways to describe somebody that's done something good for them. But in the courtroom, or you see police, they often will say that solely relates to person just supplying drugs, and that's the only way it can be used, and that's it. And that's far from the truth, because BBC speakers use it in day-to-day speech, like it's a word, it's just part of terminology. So you see that happening and time and time again, and then you see the media run with this anti-black, you know, linguistic injustice, and they're using it like, oh, this is roadman talk. Actually, no, this is how Black British people, a lot of Black British people speak, and Black British English speakers speak. And by you suggesting it's roadman talk, you're suggesting that BBC speakers are roadmen, and they're not roadmen. So it's like, why are you characterising language in a way that's very far from the truth? But also, it's in a way to demonise and make Black British English speakers feel as there's something wrong with them speaking like that, because it's only for roadmen. And that's not true. Like, roadmen are part of the Black British community, and also they are Black British English speakers, but they're not the only Black British English speakers. So why is it that you're coming at it from a lens that is criminalised, if that makes sense, when they're just language speakers like anybody else, and you should call it, oh, these... It's a language that is Black British English, and that she recalled that. Like, why are you using it in that sort of manner? We know how so often Black people have been criminalized, and that's all part of anti-Blackness, this idea of you're a gang member, you're a thug. So it's all the same ideology that's seeping into the language issue as well. You can see it mirroring, you know, even in the courtroom, the prosecutor is like, oh, they're a gang. And it's like, no, they're a group of Black people. Why are they a gang? So it's this idea of inherently linking Blackness to criminality. And it's seeping through to everything. So I think that it's really important to unpack that and to call it out, because you're seeing the old tropes of anti-Blackness being weaponized against Black people in every facet. And that's why BLAM is pushing back, and the work that I do in the courtroom is to push back against it. Because, you know, I would like to call that we need to get a linguistic expert in the court, because the prosecution's case is wrong.
Yeah.
This is simply wrong. And the police asked the officer's not an expert. They're not an expert in Black British English, and they've interpreted the word wrongly.
I guess the police sort of angle is, well, they've only ever come across that because that's what they work in. They work in sort of crime, don't they? So
that's it. Yeah.
You know, they've got a limited experience of it, and that's, you know, they don't understand. Well, I mean, that's the charitable explanation. They don't, you know, they don't understand that.
Yeah. I like the way you put it. Very charitable. Yeah. So those are all the overlapping themes. I think, you know, for me, it's been really important to really push back and to ensure that we're creating a space that is fair and just for Black British language speakers. We're not criminalising people for the language that they speak, and actually we're being accurate as well. You know, we're being accurate in giving flowers to Black British English speakers, because you so often they are demonized, like, well, this is a bad way of speaking. And even like the use of, like, they'll be saying, oh, Wagwan is roadman language, but it's actually from Jamaican patois.
Yes.
It's used as a cognate word in Black British English, but by suggesting it's a roadman, you're literally taking away from two languages, and you're demonizing two languages, and you're characterizing them in a way that's problematic.
Yeah, I think we've talked about this before and also you've spoken to Johanna Gerwin last year, who's a linguist who's been doing some stuff about London English, and that idea of enregisterment, isn't it? I think, which is, I've only just got my head around recently, is that sort of idea that a kind of way of speaking becomes immediately associated with a kind of lifestyle and a personality. And that seems to be what has hit the British press, is like roadman becomes a thing, you know. And it's a bit like, I don't know, 20 years ago, chav speak and stuff like that. It was like it immediately brought to mind a whole social group, a way of behaving, and stereotypes, damaging stereotypes around that.
Yeah.
That was more about kind of white working class and sort of classist kind of notions. But I guess roadman's gone through a similar sort of process, hasn't it?
100%. And I feel like it's really important to push back against it, because it's rooted in racism, it's rooted in classism, and it's rooted in this imperialist, like, idea of, like, language superiority and whose language is better than who isn't, and who should be demonised for the way that they speak. Yeah. So it's a pushback.
Would you be able to just talk a little bit as well about, just before recording, we were talking about some of the work you've done around sort of criminalisation, you know, literal criminalisation of Black British English speakers in the courts. Can you tell us a bit about some of the you know, the cases there about sort of freedom of expression and particularly around sort of drill lyrics.
Yeah, so what you often find, I'm part of a campaign called Art Not Evidence, and we are a group of academics, lawyers, you name it, coming together, essentially calling out the practice of the prosecution using rap and drill music as evidence, often when there's no factual nexus to the case. But because, as we mentioned, the stereotypes with Black English speakers, but also like the way that's put on Black people, and especially in the genre of drill, it can be used as a way to put forward bad character or to paint a picture to the jury that this person is involved in criminal behavior, or that their behavior that's very fictional, that's made up as part of the music video, is used to justify that, oh, this person's a gang member, or from a music video. So we see that in the courtroom, and there's been very little challenge, like the prosecution using the evidence, and it just kind of goes in. But the work is kind of pushed against that because it has very damaging effects. Even the Manchester 10 case, they use the drum to suggest that, you know, these people are gang members, and this shows that they are disposed to criminality, when actually it's a drum of music. People are very expressive in a very fictional way, and also very fluent in BBE, and then all the stereotypes that are associated with that are in front of the jury. And then what I've also seen in my own cases is the criminalization of people that are artists. So I had a drill artist called ZK who had a criminal behavior order, and it was essentially stifling his right to freedom of expression. And ZK, again, was a fluent Black English speaker, and rap is a Black art form. And what I would argue actually to the court is that even bringing this prosecution is interfering with his human rights, because making music is a freedom of expression point. And by bringing this prosecution based around the music video that he's created and stuff like that, is actually stifling his freedom of expression, but also taking away from his art form and his work that he does. And these are the type of ways we're seeing like Black art forms being brought through the courtroom, criminalized, interfering with people's human rights. By this criminalization, we are essentially taking away from the art form, and people have whole careers, you know, in this art form, are having to turn away from it because they can no longer do what they love. And that is, you know, a damning shame. And it should never be from your art form and the work that you're doing that you can no longer, or you should be criminalized for it. It's wrong. It should not be the case. So I think it's really important that we have this Art Not Evidence campaign, because it's really forcing and bringing it into sharp focus, this normalized way of criminalizing Black British English speakers. Because by criminalizing the art form, you're inherently criminalizing the language, because language is tied to the art form. And also the art form in of itself, which is, again, a Black art form. And it's not new. Like, we know, we've seen it with the 696 forms. You know, we've seen it even when NWA started their music.
That's more my era.
Yeah, like, there was a massive move to, like, stifle them and criminalize them. So it's ongoing, and it's all linked to the anti-Blackness. So the work we're doing, again, is just to push back against it.
Okay, so we've talked about the courtroom quite a lot. Can we just move into schools for a little bit? In a blog for the Runnymede Trust, there's also a reference to language policing in schools. And I'm quoting here, when Black students' language is suppressed or outrightly banned in classrooms, they begin to absorb messages that imply Black language is incorrect and unintelligent. So what's your perspective on this, and what schools or some schools are doing here?
Yeah. So, I mean, the classroom is a space of learning. It's a space where you're told what's right and what's wrong. Mm-hmm. And if in that space you are taught to suppress yourself despite the majority of people around you being fluent Black British English speakers, you're taught that the way that you speak is wrong, you will absorb that. This is not a language I can use in a professional setting because there's something wrong with it. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you start thinking there's something wrong with yourself. The two are in tandem. And that's why we say, like, the language justice point is also a wellness point, because if this is how you speak around your friends, this is how you speak. Some people, even because they have parents that are Black British as well, and they in the household speak Black British English to their parents. If you're taught the way that you speak at home and also with amongst your friends is wrong, you start to I guess, also within yourself, internalize this sort of conditioning that there's something wrong with the way that you speak. And that is far from the truth. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the way that you speak. And actually, it's another language. I understand why, I guess, especially like maybe forced usage for, you're doing the language in which they want you to write is mainstream English. You can explain that. I think to stifle it in the classroom, like they can't speak like that, we've had people at the classroom for saying welcome to their teacher. But I know if they said bonjour to their teacher, they would be like, oh, okay, you're speaking French. Oh, this is good. Mm-hmm. You know, you're multilingual, whatever. But it, for me, it's the perception of Black, British, English and Creolized languages is inherently broken. And right. That is into the classroom space, because it's not like they're saying, okay, in this session, we're going to have workshops and lessons just on Creole languages. They don't do that. They haven't. And schools can petition for like GCSEs to be more broad. Like my teacher told me that you can do GCSE in Yoruba. I remember I was asking her about that when I was in school. The school didn't push for it. You know, they don't push for like Black languages to be in the school space. And right. I think it's inherently damning that, you know, you can be in this playground speaking that, which since you come to classroom, you're in trouble. You get in trouble for speaking it. So you're getting in trouble for showing up for your whole self in the classroom, and that can't be right. And what you had at that specific school is that not only do you have the implied messages that you can't speak it in the classroom, you're going to get in trouble for it because the school's banned these words. You're not allowed to say, oh my days, you can't say light, you can't say bear, you can't say all the words that they had in there. He cut his eye at me. So this sort of thing is, you're having to like regulate yourself, and that can't be right. You should be able to show up as your whole self in the classroom space, you know. And the work that Lam was doing is actually kind of talk about, where do these ideologies come from about language supremacy? Why are certain languages allowed to be spoken in the classroom and certain languages are allowed to be taught in the classroom? And I mentioned earlier, why are we still teaching Latin, the dead language, but the Creole language that relates directly to your students, that your students speak in their home, that will help them in learning history, that will help them develop a love for learning, die for that. But Latin, a dead language, if it is, you know, inherently superior, then what we're linking back to is white supremacy. Because all languages that are taught in the school are languages created by white people, and they're all European languages, Italian, French, Spanish. Those are languages that are upheld in the classroom space as worthy of being taught and as worthy of having value. But if you speak Black language in the classroom, like Black, British, English, you're getting in trouble. So it speaks for itself. It speaks volumes. And the work that we do at Blam is to push back against that.
I guess given your line of work as well, have you ever been told at any stage in your education, you're going to have to switch into using, you know, this code if you want to get a job, if you're going to, you know, be a lawyer, etc.? Is that something you've been told?
I remember being in school, like, I never wrote in Blackish English in the class space, but I remember always being conscious that, oh, I've got to make sure I don't write in Blackish English on my book. Like, I need to make sure. So it's like, consciously, you know, you cannot bring that into classroom space. It was like an unwritten rule.
Right.
You know? So I guess those ideologies of like grammar rules and structures that are mainstream English is like normalized in the classroom space. But you don't have any time to be creative and be like, oh, we're having a session today and we're just going to write solely in Black, British, English. And actually, there's nothing wrong with that. And your skills that you already know that are innate to you are valid in this space. Never had that. So I guess in and of itself tells you one thing. But I do remember people saying, oh, yeah, you need to like read loads of Guardian and Times newspapers and Telegraph because that's the way you should speak in court. And this is that. So it's like, it's just even people's suggestions of what you should do and how you should speak and how the barrister you should be. And do you know what I mean? All those kind of things. And I guess obviously being a barrister is a very white middle class profession anyway. So that's got its own baggage that it comes with.
Yeah.
So it's all of those things tied together. So I guess because you're in those spaces and because that's the way that for that workspace, that is the way that it's always been. And that's where they communicate in that space. And there are professions that you need to be fluent in Black, British, English. And you can do well in a lot of rappers. In order for them to do well in their work, they have to be fluent in Black, British, English. There is journalists, there are culture creators, and also like now the work we're doing on like linguists and linguism, like there are careers that require you to be fluent in Black, British, English. But it's, I think, a real shame in a school space that is not given as an option. So even the fact that the book you should just get is published by Mercury Books and Penguin, and it's written in mainstream English and also Black, British, English as well. It's written in both forms. And that's a testament to the idea and to the fact that there is a space in which Black, British, English, you can have a career in that. And actually being fluent in that is actually important. So it's actually inherent and incumbent on teachers to tell students that there are certain careers that being that rich English would be of great value, but you, you never know that.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's a really interesting point. Yeah, because the overriding sort of message that seems to come out is if you speak like that, you will never get a job, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, clearly that kind of language has got real power in lots of situations, and other kinds of language have other power in other situations. And it's about learning about both, isn't it? And understanding where it all comes from.
And I have clients that are fluent in Blackbridge English, and when I speak to them and I speak to them in Blackbridge English, I can see even the demeanor, the way they relate to me changes because they feel so comfortable, you know. And I make a conscious effort if my clients are fluent in Blackbridge English, I speak to them in Blackbridge English as well. Mm. And that helps them in the process that feels very alienating. It's like, even in my day-to-day job, being fluent in Blackbridge English is actually for me quite essential.
Yeah.
Some of my
clients
are also very fluent in it. And when I speak to them in Blackbridge English, it helps the relationship so much more.
I think that links really nicely to one of the projects that I was reading, I think in one of your blogs, is about a mental health project that you're developing and a mental health booklet that uses a combination of BBE and standard English to normalise Black expression in literature. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, that's our racial wellness booklets. And actually, they have been made now. We sent them to a number of schools.
Uh-huh.
We did a primary school one and a secondary school version. And yeah, what one thing that we was really big on, especially from what we do in classroom, what we always find, especially with our sessions that we do on Blackbridge English, they're one of our most popular sessions with young people. They literally just love it. They're like, oh my gosh, I speak another language. Oh my gosh, I keep telling me I'm doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. I just feel like different language means that you don't understand. That's why you're saying I should stop speaking about it. It's another language. And just, I remember seeing the joy and the happiness in some of the young people's faces. Mm-hmm. It just really pushed us to do more for them. As I'm talking to you now, I'm literally just looking at this young person, I'm just literally reimagining and seeing how happy they were. And it made me so happy. You know, I was like, we have to do more to show up for them. So the booklet that we created, there's affirmations in there in Blackbridge English, there's journalism in Blackbridge English, and we've got words in there, like literally, today I'm feeling gassed because of, and then you'd say, this and this happened, or yesterday I was feeling a bit, you know, down or whatever, but you know, I'm baking off by doing this. Well, do you know what I mean? Like the way that they speak in the written form is also being normalized, and it's just giving them the tools to like be expressive in whatever way they see fit, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just to kind of disrupt that hierarchy that we were talking about in terms of, you know, what languages are given credence and priority and what languages are kind of stigmatized.
100%. I guess for many of them, that's the first time they've seen their writing or the way they speak in the official document in a school setting.
Yeah.
I don't think they're likely, because we have schools that hand it out to their students. That's for the first time they've seen somebody in an official capacity, I guess, in a school setting, hand out a book to them that is written in the language they speak.
Yeah, that's powerful, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%.
So we saved the sort of linguistic beef till the last question.
Which I like that linguistic beef. Sprinkle the TV in there.
this is one of the sort of ways in which sort of we became aware of your work was from talking to Paul Kurzweil a little while ago and discussing MLE. And he's been really interested about this, because I think initially he thought what you were saying about MLE was wrong, but I think he's come around to your way of thinking a lot more about this. Your kind of take, and I think you wrote about this in the Blam blog a couple of years ago, was how you say the term multicultural London English is like a kind of mislabeling, and actually what it does is it erases Black British English. So why do you think MLE is the wrong term to be using, and how does that kind of square with your conversations you've had with linguists about it?
Yeah, I think it's the wrong term to be using, because in the 80s, the word Black British English was used by white linguists in the UK. So it's always been a term, and somehow in like the early 2000s or that period, it lost its way and they started using multicultural London English. And I feel like that word means everything and nothing. And I think it's from that at that time where like ideology of multiculturalism was like alive and well, and people use that term a lot. But I think it seeped into the language space. I for me, the term multicultural London English isn't helpful, because Black British English speakers are not restricted to London. They're in Birmingham, they're in Manchester. And I say that because the base of Black British English is 100% Patois. Like, there's so many words that, as I'm doing my research, I'm picking up as this is Jamaican Patois, the word ends, the word peng. So many words that have been normalized as just standard BBE is Jamaican Patois. So it's actually incumbent that we give our flowers to the Black British community and Jamaican community for creating this language, because if not for the Blackness, if not for the Jamaican Patois, the language wouldn't exist, because the majority of the word is Jamaican Patois. But when you have terms like multicultural and English, it just divorces it from the history, from hearing it. Multicultural means everything and nothing. It doesn't have a direct cultural group to link it to. Whereas the Black Britishness, and even in general, we say all the time, a lot of Black British culture is Jamaican culture anyways. There's a very strong prevalence of Jamaican culture and Caribbean culture in Black Britishness anyways, along with other Black cultures like West African cultures as well, but it's a lot of it is a Jamaican culture as well. So with the Black Britishness, you're still, and the reason why we say Black British English, because whilst the base of it is Jamaican Patois, the language structure, the grammar rules are slightly different. And also you have other languages that have influenced it, like Nigerian Pidgin. You've got a lot of Arabic terms, you've got Somali terms, and you've also got a lot of like BBE terms that are created by BBE speakers. And the language use is quite different to an extent. But the base of it, again, as I said, is Jamaican Patois. So by calling it multicultural English and London English, you're restricting to London only, but also you're erasing that history.
Mm.
I mean, also, there's a lot of AABE terms as well that are part of Black British English. So you're erasing, and I've written about this quite a lot, there's like a Black Atlantic culture expression and creolized language creation, where there's a way that, you know, Black people creolized English, and you see that in AABE and Jamaican Patois and Pidgin, and that's kind of immigrated into BBE. So when you divorce it from that and call it multicultural and English, you just erase all of that. I just don't, as I mentioned, because BBE is spoken in, or multicultural and English, as they were to say, is spoken in Manchester and Birmingham, and it's, for them, it's very fluent and free-flowing, because a lot of our descendants of one generation, they may be Jamaican or other Caribbean islands, in which terms in BBE that are from those countries that are part of different Caribbean Creoles are also spoken, they can immediately relate and speak the language, because it's also part of their own language, their own heritage language. So when you call it not multicultural English, you erase all of that. And I also say a lot, I feel that because linguism and linguists in the country remain very white, that was an oversight.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting angle, isn't it? Because I think that's something that, you know, the sociolinguists who research it are aware of themselves, aren't they? I think they're aware of their whiteness and investigating a space, a linguistic space that is not the language they use. You definitely need people within the communities to be the linguists within those communities, like you've kind of talked about earlier, to actually research the language that they use. It's all around them, and have that insider's insight. That would be a huge kind of help to the study of language, wouldn't it? Do you think, though, I mean, there's a couple of things maybe around this. Do you think there's an argument that certainly vocabulary-wise, MLE is drawing really heavily on Jamaican Patois, but actually phonologically, you know, in terms of, you know, the way it sounds and maybe even some of the sort of grammar structures, it's not necessarily just drawing from that, that there is a more genuinely kind of multicultural influence on that? And then I guess secondly, is there maybe an argument to say that, you know, one of the things about MLE that may make it actually a useful kind of term is that it kind of reflects the fact that this is an organic bottom-up kind of language that is spoken by all sorts of people who aren't just from Black British English backgrounds? I mean, what do you think of those?
No. But the reason I say no is Black British English, like, and we do it, obviously, the English at the end of it, it's got influences, you know, of Cockney, it's got influence of London English and stuff, but no more, no less than any other Creole. Like, Creole-based languages have an influence of English, but it doesn't mean it's a multicultural language. Like, I just feel like it's just inherently wrong. Like, I always say this, English is, it fits the definition of a Creole language. It's got French, Latin, a Germanic dialect, some Celtic words all mixed together, but nobody's calling it multi-European language. Like, it's called English. So why is it that when it's something that is inherently Black, And I would argue some of the grammar structures are coming from Jamaican patois, because the use of the man and she, that is also like in the to refer to the first person and stuff, that does also come from Jamaican patois. And for me, even like the way I'm seeing the way Black English is evolving, I'm seeing that people saying I beg, and they're saying sha, and they're saying nyash. These are all terms from Nigerian pidgin, soft life, all these. So, and even the way the language is spoken and the rules and stuff, I would say they are unique to BBE. They are unique, and they also draw on the influence of the way in which these other creoles I've mentioned, pidgin and patois and AB, spoken. And it's got such a heavy influence of those languages. I just think that it's not right to call it multicultural English. And the same thing is happening in America. They're like all calling it TikTok lingo and slang. But it's Black people that created it. And then because Blackness is inherently linked to coolness, and that's another whole thing to unpack in and of itself, things that we create get co-opted, and then we get pushed out, and then people are like, oh, it's for everybody. No, Black people created this. Give Black people their flowers. Of course, other people are going to engage in language, but I do think when they do engage in the language, it does add to the erasure. I always give an example of Love Island. On Love Island, Hugo, a white middle class guy, started using moving mad. Moving mad is a Black British English term. The Metro put on the front page, Hugo created this term, moving mad. The Black community on Twitter showed Metro they were moving mad and cussed Metro. Yes. And Metro put the headline down. But the reason why I say it's really important that we, and I find it very interesting, because everybody else that creates a language and that their language is based around what they have created, French, for example, they get their flowers. The French will always let you know magnificent is a French word. Fatigue is a French word. Yeah, they will always let you know. But when it comes to things Black people create, oh, it's everybody's. No, it's wrong. And it's just going to the issue of erasure and not giving Black people their flowers. And I think it's really wrong. And I think we have to, because but for the Jamaican influence and also the Black British community, Black British English wouldn't be a thing. We popularize it through song, music, through culture, through social media. And that's how it's become. Other people are using it. Other races are using it. But when you, because I thought the other Central C was saying the word nyash is UK slang. Even my mom uses the word nyash. So it's like, when you're saying this, you're erasing things. It's really, really important that we give Black people their flowers for the language creation that they have created. Other people want to use it, fair enough. But you cannot erase the Blackness, because you are erasing history. And all too often, Black history is erased. And I think we're in dangerous territory for doing that in the language space as well.
That's a great way to end it all. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it. I even got more stuff to add to my book now. Because I'm like, even the point I was saying to you about, actually, like in school, I was doing a research. I was like, actually, you just have to sit down and think about something and you actually remember. I'm like, oh, that's nice. We were literally doing linguist work and linguism in school on Creole based languages, and we never knew it.